Welcome everyone to episode 206 of the Reds Unrestricted podcast. I'm your host David Comerford and I'm joined by Chris Coughlin as we discuss Liverpool's 2-1 win over Brighton in the Premier League.
This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
So Liverpool fell behind again against Brighton. This time it was after 87 seconds, which is actually the earliest they've gone behind at Anfield in the Premier League since October 2019, when Harry Kane scored for Tottenham inside the first minute. But Luis Diaz got them level just before the half hour. And then with about a quarter of the game to go, Mohamed Salah scored the winning goal. And it's actually the seventh game this season Liverpool have won from behind in the league. And that's the most they've managed in a top flight campaign. Well, since it became the Premier League anyway. So another big accolade and one that's been a defining feature of this season. And also something that I noticed shortly before we started recording, Liverpool now on to 67 points. And if that rings a bell, it's the same figure they achieved in the entirety of last season, which just shows how much of a turnaround there has been. And it was, of course, as well, the 300th win under Jurgen Klopp. And with the draw between Man City and Arsenal in a game that was hotly anticipated and did not live up to the hype at all. But it's a good result for Liverpool because it means they are 2 points clear of Arsenal at the top, with City a point further back. And we will talk about our impressions from that match. And of course, the title race before we finish today's podcast. But before that, we've got Liverpool's match to dissect. And we'll begin, Chris, as we usually do, with our three match reviews and your take on that Liverpool performance. Because they had to work hard, but they did play pretty well at the same time.
Yeah, they definitely have to work hard, didn't they? My three-word match review, I hope I'm not stealing yours with this, but I'll keep it simple with the comeback kings. Again, as you say, the amount of games Liverpool come from behind to win this season. I checked just before we came on. 26 points from losing positions, more than Liverpool have ever achieved. I'm not sure, as you say, whether that's since it became 3 points for a win or just in the Premier League year as a whole. But it shows a great mentality. It shows a real willingness and desire to get back into the game. Admittedly, we do have to look at the other side of it in that football is a low-scoring sport, and ideally you really don't want to be going behind on too many occasions because Liverpool won't be able to do that every single time they go behind for the rest of the season, you would imagine. So it does need to really step up a gear in terms of how Liverpool start games, because again, I think it's been a regular occurrence, relatively speaking, this season where Liverpool haven't started games great. I'm thinking like the Bournemouth game example at the start of the season as well, where Liverpool go behind early on and have to come from behind to win games. So football's a lot easier if you don't have to go scoring two or three to win matches. But I said going into the game, with keeping City Arsenal in mind, that Liverpool just had to win. And then whatever happened at the Etihad happened. And ultimately, it has been a very good Sunday for Liverpool when you consider the two results and plenty of positives, not least, and I will touch on this now just to get it in, Liverpool, for me, were up against more than just Brighton today, because I'm not sure what match David Koo was watching to be able to hand out as many yellow cards as he did. But that's his prerogative. But yes, Liverpool did very well to overcome several obstacles.
Yeah, it was interesting with the ref because you watch the City v Arsenal game and I don't know how many yellow cards there ended up being, but just the contrast in literally one game to the very next one between a referee who was brandishing them for fun and then another one who didn't want to show them, just that consistency buzzword again. It's interesting you mentioned the points from losing positions, because on the flip side of that, there was a stat yesterday in the Aston Villa v Wolves game that caught my eye. And Villa have dropped the fewest points in the league from winning positions with three. Obviously, they maintained that record yesterday with that 2-0 victory. But off the top of my head, I think Liverpool were right there after them with four the whole season. And for me, that's a combination that wins you a title, basically being able to fight back and being able to hold on, being able to manage games. And to be fair, Liverpool's game management, I think, was absolutely perfect here. But over the course of the season, the proof is in the pudding. And that is a fantastic record to have at both sides of that scale, I suppose. So I just wanted to mention that. In terms of my three words, I've gone with bogey team beaten, because if there's any side in the league, and maybe Brighton are too good to be called a bogey team, but Liverpool haven't actually beaten Brighton at home since the season where they won the Premier League, a game where I believe Alisson got sent off.
Van Dijk brace. Yeah,
bizarre game. And since then, season after, they lost to them at home. In 21-22, it was one of those costly draws. I think Liverpool were 2-0 up and ended up going 2-2. And then last season, obviously, it was a 3-3 draw as well. And in that period as well, Liverpool have only actually had one victory, full stop, against Brighton, which was the away game in 21-22. So whether it was Potter or whether it was the Derby, Liverpool really have struggled against this opponent. And then obviously when Welbeck scores early on, you think, is it going to be more of the same? Is it going to be more drop points? But finally, Liverpool able to get that victory against the Seagulls. And I did think that Liverpool responded well to going behind in the first half. I thought it was a good performance in that period. 14 shots against three in that first 45 minutes. 1.3 XG against 0.13. So it was one of them where, especially with Diaz scoring, you thought if there was more of the same in the second half, that Liverpool were going to be fine. I thought the start of the second half, Liverpool regressed a little bit in terms of the level they were performing at. Didn't create too much clear cut, I think, before Salah got what proved to be the winning goal. Interestingly, on Salah, I mean, we're going to talk about the standout player soon. He wasn't one of those in this game. I turned to my mate who I was watching the game with and sort of said at the start, you know, the worse, we've said it before in this podcast, Chris, you know, almost the worse he plays, the more confident you are that he's going to score. And sure enough, he did. But one thing that I didn't sort of process at the time, but I've since found out, was that he had 12 shots in this game, which is the most he's ever had in a Premier League match, and the most on record by Liverpool player in the competition. And the third bit of that stat is that it's the most by any player in the Premier League since Zlatan Ibrahimovic against Burnley in October 2016, who also had 12. It didn't feel like he had that many shots, but it was certainly a game where he had to toil anyway. But classic Salah this season, as the match winner. You know, myself and Jamie did a podcast in the week about who the player of the year is. We did mention Salah. One thing we didn't, I think, touch on was the fact that his performances certainly haven't been player of the year worthy, but maybe his numbers are. And then when Liverpool were 2-1 up, I thought, in terms of that game management point I made, I just thought there was moments where they were rushing things around the box, trying to play a killer pass, trying to, you know, go for a questionable shot. And you're winning the game, just pass the ball backwards and just wait for the, you know, the real proper opening in that scenario, because you don't need to rush any. And, you know, you're better to keep the ball than try a low percentage effort, a low percentage pass or anything like that. But having said that, Brighton didn't really have too much clear cut, only 0.31 XG in the whole second half. Adam Lallana had kind of a half chance. Welbeck did as well. One or two slightly nervy moments, but Liverpool generally managed it really well against a team who, granted, they did have injuries, but have caused those problems and tend to cause big teams, certainly last season anyway, a lot of issues. But before we move on to sort of the players who stood out to us, I just want to revisit a couple of those points with you, Chris. I mean, there wasn't too much wrong, really, with how Liverpool played in that game, was there? I mean, they go behind early, and that is an issue. But in terms of responding to that and the level of control they exerted for much of the game, it was quite a commanding performance overall, wasn't it?
It was. And part of the frustration, I know I mentioned David Coote earlier on, but it was like you just forgot football was a contact sport. I thought Liverpool really did well in getting in Brighton's faces, but every little thing was getting pulled up, and you kind of lose track of the dominance Liverpool had because they weren't being allowed to basically give Brighton a bit of a rough time, you know. And Brighton are an excellent counter-attacking team, but I thought in the most part Liverpool did so well in several parts in terms of nullifying it. Certainly in the second half, there was a brilliant moment from Jarrell Quanson. It looked like he was going to get beaten down the right-hand side, down the right-back side. His acceleration was just absolutely phenomenal and able to get the ball plenty of time, keep it in play and play a pass. But yeah, it is kind of easy to forget the dominance Liverpool had at times. But if anything, that really does say how well they did do to come into against the team, as you say. Brighton are a bogey side, and it almost that feels like it's an obstacle overcome as well, just to get that almost wall knocked down and move through it and get three ultimately big points. And who knows, obviously, what this result could be come the end of the season as well. I thought overall, I know we'll discuss some individuals in a bit, but I thought Liverpool really grew into the midfield battle, because I thought Brighton were really bossing that earlier on. But the longer the game went on, the midfield became more and more influential, more and more dominant. And that was really showing at the end, because there were a few quiet performances all over the, not all over the pitch, maybe further up front. I thought Nunez had a quietish game. Salah, as you say, the amount of shots he had, but how good a game did he actually have? And Diaz, yeah, I'll discuss him more in a bit. But yeah, a typically chaotic Luis Diaz performance, but ultimately a big contribution from him. So yeah, good performances all round. And it should have been a more clear scoreline than it was, really. But ultimately, it's 3 points, and I think that's really what matters today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, looking at the fixtures, Liverpool have Sheffield United on Thursday. And then in terms of home games, Spurs, Wolves and Crystal Palace to come. So I think that game today was the second hardest home game Liverpool have got left this season. When you look at those opponents, obviously Spurs being the one that stands out, but really tricky game and important to come through it, definitely. In terms of like Brighton's approach, I thought, you know, we've seen De Zerbi with a lot of clever sort of tactics in these games. It felt like his main approach here was kind of obviously that signature baiting of the press and then almost basically play a ball from the centre-back straight to one of the forwards who kind of have his back to goal, and you basically take the Liverpool midfield out of the game and then set up a favourable attacking situation. And they did do that a few times, but it felt like they went then. I think Liverpool recovered quite well in those moments when they did get kind of split and got back into positions where, I mean, Brighton did have, you know, their fair share of dangerous attacks. But I think Liverpool managed to kind of limit the quality of the opportunities they got from them quite well. So that was another strong aspect of the performance. And it's good to see Klopp kind of be able to nullify a manager who has caused him so many issues in the past and has been able to pick holes in his setup as well. A manager, incidentally, and obviously we won't get into this too much today, but who is in contention for the Liverpool job now that Xabi Alonso decided to stay at Bayer Leverkusen. So in terms of the standout players, we'll start with Diaz. I mean, I wasn't really sure who to kind of go with first, but seeing as you mentioned him there, Chris, I thought that was one of his better performances this season. In addition to his goal, which was obviously a big one, he created two big chances. I thought he was relentless in and out of possession in that game. When he had the ball, made some good decisions. And in a weird way, I'd describe it as quite a clean performance, if that makes sense, because I think sometimes he's a little bit scruffy, a little bit erratic in his game. But that one, just everything felt a bit more smooth, a bit more together. And I think that's reflected in the fact that he's come off the pitch completing 34 out of 37 passes, which is excellent for a forward. And I think it's a point that Mark's made a couple of times on post-match podcasts about how for a forward, he has got very good passing accuracy and ability to kind of hold on to the ball under pressure. So I was really impressed with him today, especially after, I think, you know, the last Premier League game Liverpool played against Man City. When things were a little bit more haywire for him, let's say. How did you think he did?
I think Luis Diaz is a very funny character, and I think he is at a bit of a crucial period in his Liverpool career, because, I mean, you of course, did the podcast recently about keep, loan, sell. I know Diaz wasn't on that list in particular, but I'd be very intrigued to hear from Liverpool fans. In terms of, say, if a big bid came in for Luis Diaz this summer, what kind of bid would entice you to sell? Because for me, I've been thinking about this a lot recently with Luis Diaz, and he's a very exciting footballer. But one thing that I just worry about with him is crucial moments. And look, Sadio Mane is a Liverpool legend. Another stratosphere to pretty much most left wingers on the planet in recent years. But what it was with Mane, crucial moments, right? And for example, Diaz had a chance against Man City. It was almost a carbon copy of when Mane was through against Bournemouth back in 2020, just before COVID lockdown. and he finishes it with aplomb. Diaz doesn't finish it against City, and ultimately the game finishes 1-1. And that's been my big question mark about Luis Diaz recently, in terms of, is he a player that can provide crucial moments? And I've got to, you know, take my hat off to him, even though I'm not wearing one, I'm wearing headphones. But I've got to really praise him for that finish today, because that was a crucial goal. And I think I'm looking back at the season now. Diaz, of course, the equaliser against Luton, equaliser against Bournemouth at the start of the season. So I'm not saying he hasn't had key contributions. I'm just doubting him in terms of in big moments and big games.
Right.
And I am, you know, I'm not on the sell Luis Diaz brigade, if there are people talking about that. But what I'm saying is, if a big bid came in for him, I think people would be more willing to listen to it than if Sadio Mane at the similar kind of age, if that makes sense. And I think that is why Luis Diaz is in such a crucial part of his Liverpool career, because these next 9 games, and it is a case of we're taking one game at a time. It absolutely is. But let's not say that Liverpool aren't in a position where they have it in their own hands now. And Luis Diaz could well have really important moments in the next 9 games, because he will be first choice on that left-hand side, I think, for the running. And he's got to finish them, hopefully with aplomb like he did today. It was a brilliant finish, really reactive finish, really, really good strike. But he needs to have more of them going forward. And I just hope that's a really confident one, because, again, people could well say that he might have been onside in another world for his second goal, toenails, etc. But I think today was just, I felt like he was trying to get more involved in actual goal scoring today, which I think is a really positive sign. And I think it could well turn out to be a really important moment for him in his Liverpool career going forward, because he will be a really important player for the next 2 months. Really important.
Do you know what? I mean, that's a really interesting point. And also, I mean, I think the key thing, like you said, is as much as, you know, Gakpo is coming back. Well, Gakpo is obviously always available. Jota's coming back into the team soon. We think it does feel like, I mean, how many games left? Nine games
in the league. Yeah,
9 league games. You know, you'd expect Diaz to start minimum 6, probably 7, 8, or 9.
At least, yeah.
Yeah, of those, even with, you know, the options there. I mean, I think it's probably not as a criticism of Nunez, but I think with Jota coming back, he's maybe a bit more likely to lose his place, it seems to me. So I think you're right that he's going to have a lot of big moments in his hands, especially, I mean, you look at the fixtures that we'll have to play, Man United away, Spurs at home, Villa away, some tricky games left, and they're going to be games that probably are going to be decided by the odd goal. And that's when you need, obviously, clinical finishing, and that's probably why it's important that Jota's coming back as well. Hopefully he can help Liverpool in that regard. I'll throw it straight back to you then, Chris. I mean, obviously, we talked about Diaz now. Who were the other players that you want to kind of mention today and really kind of pick out as many as you want? Don't hesitate, because I do think there were plenty today who kind of deserve some praise for how they did.
Can we just spend an hour talking about Conor Bradley?
I'd be happy with that. He's literally done absolutely everything in that game. I mean, I'll read out his stats in a second when you've finished talking, but yeah, what a performance. Again, phenomenal.
Just absolutely incredible. Last few weeks, I've been working with the Bolton fan as well. I've just been saying to her, whatever Bolton did to Conor Bradley, yeah, thank you, cheers. Because, I mean, he just transformed. I said this because I was at the second leg against Sparta Prague, and he looks like he's bulked up. Don't know about you, Dave, as well. It looks like he's put on a bit of meat, a bit of muscle. And it looks like he's just really aggressive, really dominant in that role now. And the best part about Conor Bradley is, and this is no criticism of Trent Alexander-Arnold, because I'm sick to the back teeth of people talking about his lack of defensive prowess or whatever, but it does feel like Conor Bradley has the best of both worlds. He's really good going forward, but at the back, he's really dependable. There were two parts in about a couple of minutes today in the first half where I think it was Welbeck and then Adingra, almost in the exact same scenario at the cop end, where Bradley won two goal kicks in really quick succession. But that's because he's just really strong in those defensive duels, even at his age. And it's absolutely fantastic. You know, you're seeing a lad who's 20 years old for Northern Ireland as well. He played in midfield against Scotland. So he's showing his versatility. He's a star boy for his country. He's becoming very quickly off that ilk for Liverpool. Let's face it. Trent Alexander-Arnold said before the game today, I know I'm not expecting to get back in this team, but I'm going to work for it. And Jurgen Klopp's got to find a way for me to find a way to fit both of them in. Because Conor Bradley's performances do not warrant a place on the bench. They warrant starting games. He's been that good all over the place. And he's just absolutely incredible. It obviously, I think he might have even played more games if he'd not been injured at the start of the season, but the way he's just come in so seamlessly. And Jurgen Klopp's learnt a little bit as well, because I throw back, I've never thrown it back before, but to the COVID season, when he eventually bit the bullet and went for the centre-halves of Philipson and Williams, as opposed to having to fill in with Fabinho and Henderson, everything else that happened that season. He's not tried to put square pegs in round holes with Conor Bradley. He's just gone, you're a young player, you're a right back, I know you've got ability, go in and show us what you can do. And he has been phenomenal from the second he got that starting jersey for Liverpool a couple of months ago. So again, I could go on more about Conor Bradley, but there are a few other players. Start of the season, I said my prediction for signing of the season would be Alexis McAllister. And boy, is he growing into the role now. Obviously, look, we talk about Endo a lot, and again, could say about how great he was today. But what he's doing is allowing McAllister to move further forward, and he is perfect in that further forward role for Liverpool. He really is. He was getting better in the sixth role anyway, but what he's doing in the forward positions now is just absolutely brilliant. And what a delicate pass that was to Mo Salah. So difficult to pull that off, to find Salah, but also to give him the time and space to get the ball out of his feet to have a shot. Fantastic play by McAllister. Both ends of the pitch as well. He's performing so well. Just the ideal central midfielder for Liverpool. And yeah, but he wasn't exactly an unknown gem that Liverpool fans, a World Cup winner, for God's sake, when he joined the club. But the scouting that's gone in to be able to get him for the price they did as well, and just the work that went into it, and the relationships that were built with Brighton, and the performances that he has now putting in on such a consistent basis, it's absolutely fantastic. In terms of others around the pitch, I think if I'm to mention the whole midfield again, I think Szoboszlai is getting a little bit back into the groove. I probably would like a few more goals and assists contributions from him, but I'm sensing he's getting his groove back somewhat. He's not up to the level that he was at the start of the season yet, but we're sensing a bit more adventure from him in the last few weeks. So the midfield for me was really, as I mentioned before, really was the star of the show today. And there, that's where I'm going to give the plaudits alongside Conor Bradley.
I mean, with McAllister as well, like, you know, the all-round game is obviously the big thing, but 5 goals, 7 assists, all gone positions now. Great numbers for a player who's alternating between the positions that he's been in. Talk about the positions. I mean, remember the first game Liverpool played against Brighton, which I think was in early October. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Around that time.
The 2-2.
Yeah, the 2-2. Yeah,
and he didn't... It was the start of the game, wasn't he? He was getting run ragged.
He made a mistake. I think he gave the ball away before Brighton. I think Brighton went 1-0 up. It was Brighton 1-0 and Liverpool scored twice just before half-time. Yeah. And then it finished 2-2. I think McAllister made a mistake for that first goal. The contrast between that performance, there were some good elements in that game, but he looked like... I think that was probably when the positional conversation kind of peaked. Now, obviously, in a more favoured role, the difference that you see. And he is just, for me, week after week now, and it feels like every single time we're doing one of these podcasts, it's how good was McAllister in this game. And he's been world class for, you know, pretty much the entirety of 2024. Liverpool's best player in this calendar year for me, without any doubt. Signing of the season conversation as well. I think you're right to bring that up, Chris, because he's very much in there. Liverpool's best signing and one of the best signings in the Premier League this year. And I think if Liverpool do go on to win the league, then that might be what kind of tips it for him, to be honest. And I do think he's consistently looked much better playing alongside Endo. The first couple of games, I think when he shifted forward, it wasn't maybe the immediate results you expected, but now that those two have an understanding playing alongside them, one another, the balance looks kind of impeccable. 58 passes completed today from 63 attempted. Five of those were key passes, chances created as well. So, what a performance for him. And that is why when we signed him, I was so excited to see what he could do, especially for the price tag, because just the quality of the player that we were getting, and we're seeing it now. He took a little bit of time to bed in. Obviously, was there an adjustment period there with the position too? That's a big factor in all of it. But now, in a more comfortable role, in a side where he's settled, in a team that is firing on all cylinders at the moment, certainly in the Premier League anyway, is just showing that he is an absolute top player. And I saw someone on Twitter say before that he's the best midfielder in the Premier League right now. And I don't think you can... there's a few other players you can toss into it, but just in terms of current form, I think it's hard to say anyone is doing better than him. Although the press will have you think that it's Kobbie Mainoo as well. So that's a factor definitely. In terms of some other players, Endo, I know you gave him a shout, Chris, but I just think it's incredible to watch him play at the level that he is, given the circumstances of his signing, a 30-year-old for a low price tag, who was basically just signed because Klopp had a bit of a hunch about him. And I think the new manager will be very thankful to Klopp for doing that, because he's playing like a top defensive midfielder at the moment, looks more assertive by the game. His ability to wrap his leg round an attacker and win the ball back reminds me a little bit of Fabinho at times. And that's what I mean when I say about being a top defensive midfielder. And here's a question to you, Chris, and I also want to follow up on something you said about Bradley as well. But who do you think drops out of the team when Curtis Jones comes back? Because Klopp said today that Jones is basically back in full training and should be in contention for the game against Sheffield United. Obviously, it'll take him a couple of games to get back into that starting 11 rhythm. But for you, does Jones come back in first of all? And if so, which of those three are you moving out? I mean, I imagine it's probably not going to be McAllister, but of the three or of the two, as it may be, who drops out for you?
Firstly, just with regards to Sheffield United, I would go pretty much what it was today, because I'm of the opinion that you go strong, you get 3-0 up, 4-0 up, whatever it could be, and that's no disrespect to Sheffield United, but I think that's the kind of scoreline Liverpool really should be aiming for on Thursday. And then you make the changes, because I don't think, the way Liverpool are at the moment, a lot of games coming up, but I don't think there's a need for change. I think you go with what you know that can win games and really stick with that. So I'm expecting Curtis Jones to be on the bench. I think that's pretty much everyone's expectation, really. But I think you have got to kind of say Szoboszlai, really, because what we've said is that Endo is so brilliant at the six, you can't take him out. McAllister's benefiting from that so well, so you can't take him out. So it is that right-sided central midfield position that is the biggest debate, if you like. And I do think that is where Jones will be in battle with Szoboszlai, Gravenberg, and Trent Alexander-Arnold, if we're being honest. So that's where the most competition is. You said about Diaz earlier in terms of the game being expected. I would very much expect Alexis McAllister to start injury-free, touch wood, the next 9 Premier League games. And I don't think that's outlandish. I think that's just a fact. I think that's what everybody would be thinking. With Tadu Endo, I would not be surprised if he started all 9 remaining as well, really. So I think it's that third midfield spot that really is up for grabs, and finding a way to, it's a great problem. It's a great problem, but how he fits everyone in, because in my opinion, you can't drop Conor Bradley. I mean, damn, I'm glad I'm not Jurgen Klopp deciding all that. But I think Gravenberg's at the bottom of that list. And then for me, when everyone's fit, see, this sounds so harsh, because I think Curtis Jones would have been in the England squad had he been fully fit. this last international break. But I'm then thinking Jones and then Szoboszlai Alexander-Arnold are kind of on the same level in terms of being selected for that role. But yeah, we've gone from a situation with Liverpool, and Jürgen Klopp is saying he's sick and tired of hearing people talk about a wealth of options where Liverpool have been almost struck down in recent weeks to having almost too many to choose from. But when you're going for the title and you're going for the Europa League, those options will come in very handy, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And with regards to midfield, it is obviously a major headache, like you say, and I suppose you sort of answered the question there about Bradley as well in terms of keeping him in the side through potentially, you know, using Trent in that number eight role too. But yeah, I think with the difficulty with taking Szoboszlai out of the team for Jones would be, and I know that Jones has had an important contribution, I just think that he's the most kind of athletic midfielder Liverpool have got, and the ground he covers game to game. I almost think you can kind of underrate what he does out of possession because sort of focused on him maybe not being at the same level with the ball than he was at the start of the season. But I think the amount of work he consistently gets through the defensive impact he makes is something that we would miss if we took him out the side. So I would probably be inclined to stick with the three that we've seen today, you know, up until the point where they struggle or Jones, you know, particularly impresses, basically forces away into the team on, you know, as a substitute. And I do think, you know, you mentioned McCalla, so I would agree that he probably will start every game unless there's one where Klopp feels he has to rotate. And then it's kind of who fits in alongside him. And I think there might be a bit of rotation there, but I, at the moment, would say stick with the three from today for the majority of games. But maybe there's an argument there to put Jones in for matches where Liverpool need that kind of control and player that Jones has been quite effectively so far this year. So it's a really interesting one, and we'll obviously see how that one evolves and when Jones is ready to start. Probably, I mean, it's going to depend on how many minutes he plays on Thursday in terms of Man United, but you may be looking at the following game, which is it against Crystal Palace after Man United?
Yeah, the first leg against Atalanta.
Atalanta, yeah. Maybe that's the one that he targets, and that's the one where this is really going to kind of fit into place as well. By Cetic coming back too, but I think before the end of the season, but he's going to be obviously very carefully managed, definitely. So just to round off on the players, I think I'll just quickly nod to Kwanzaa. He's very close to matching Konate for minutes played now. He's played just 2,016 minutes he's played, and Konate's played 2,164, which is unbelievable. Again, one of them where if someone had said to you at the start of the season, a lot of people would be like, who's Jarrod Kwanzaa? A lot of people would have been like, surely not, you know, what's happened there? But just shows how trusted he is. And I think he did an interview recently where he talked about how he's learning things from every centre-back, and Matip, his ability going forward and carrying the ball. And I do think that there's a lot more assertiveness from him in possession now as well, which is an asset to Liverpool and hopefully someone he can build on in kind of the next couple of seasons of his career. And like I said, I will just mention Bradley's stats from today. 3 interceptions, 6 tackles, 11 out of 16 ground duels won, 4 key passes and 4 out of 6 dribbles. I mean, that is a complete performance from a fullback. And again, I mean, we're talking about the midfield. It is one that gives not only Klopp, but also his successor a big dilemma in terms of the balance between him and Trent Alexander-Arnold. And just to tie all that up, I mean, Endo, Kwanzaa, Bradley, 3 players there who arguably aren't first choice players for Liverpool. Obviously, Endo, it's a bit up in the air, but certainly the other two in terms of having Konate and Trent Alexander-Arnold. But I do think it's players like that that this title race has been built on, given the extent of injuries. And I think they've been brilliant for a long time now, and they're absolutely brilliant again in this game. So we'll just finish off then by talking about Man City v Arsenal and the title race. Goalless draw, not a very good game. I think nothing memorable happened on the pitch, it's probably fair to say. But obviously, you're going to have pretty big ramifications for the title race. Chris, what did you think of that goalless draw at the Etihad? And what do you think about the title race now, given that we've seen a final meeting between these kind of 3 teams at the top of the table?
I think it was very much a game that, as it went on, you realised both teams were more concerned about not losing than winning. And I think at the end of it, the result probably suits Arsenal more than it suits Manchester City, mainly because it's a home game for City. Of course, they're so imperious at home. But I think a draw probably is what most Liverpool fans would have wanted, really. And I think ultimately the whole day played out in a kind of ideal fashion for Liverpool, I think. I was really intrigued by City in terms of just the lack of penetration. And look, Arsenal, I think, are by far and away the best defence this season regarding XGC. So expected goals conceded, I think they're by far and away the best in terms of expected least goals conceded. But I didn't really feel they were tested that much by De Bruyne, by Haaland. I think the most telling factor really was that Foden went off after 61 minutes, and I don't really know what Pep Guardiola's plan was there. So it's a result overall. Liverpool will more than take it, of course. Liverpool still have so much work to do to even think about being in a position to reclaim the title. But if you'd have said, if you'd have shown this league table to Liverpool fans at the start of the day and said, would you take it? Of course. 99.9% would have said, yeah, I'd be interested to find out if someone wouldn't have taken it that way. But looking at the rest of the season, yeah, it's interesting that as well, I think, off the top of my head, most of the difficult games for everybody are quite similar. I think Liverpool and Arsenal both have to play Manchester United and Tottenham. City, of course, have Villa on Wednesday and Spurs away as well. And that'll be very interesting because Manchester City, first of all, need to unlock the achievement of scoring at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium in the Premier League. So I think if I look at the fixtures, because I've had a look at this, I think from this point on, City have the most desirable run in, really. But of course, football is played on the pitch. It's not played in predictions, and everyone's got a lot of work to be doing. But Liverpool, I think when they get the bit between their teeth, they're really good at pushing on. And just touch on again for Sheffield United on Thursday, and this is no mean to disrespect them, of course. They have picked up slightly in recent weeks, the draw at Bournemouth and the 3-3, which they really should have won against Fulham. Because I've watched that fourth goal that got ruled out, and I still can't really figure it out. I kind of can, but I kind of can't, if you know what I mean. So they picked up in recent weeks, but I really do think that is a game where goal difference should really be considered. 3 points, of course, but goal difference to come with it, because Arsenal still have the advantage in that regard, and I don't think they'll be letting up. Of course, they've got Luton this week as well at the Emirates, so really important midweek with all three teams at home. And I'm predicting 3 wins, so let's see if it plays out that way. But hopefully Liverpool, a result and performance against Sheffield United to really assert their dominance at the top of the table.
Yeah, I think it's fair enough to talk about goal difference. I mean, they've conceded 77 goals this season, which is 12 more than Burnley, who are second in that sort of table. And 77 is appalling at this stage of the season, let's be honest. So fingers crossed, from a Liverpool standpoint, that looks quite a lot worse after Thursday. But they made things difficult against Luton at home. They made things difficult against Burnley at home. So they need to be on it still, even if Sheffield United are a poor side. My takeaways from the game, Arsenal, the optimistic, the positive analysis for them is that I think they are probably the best defensive team in Europe this season. I mean, they are absolutely rock solid, but they did not approach that game like Liverpool would have. They played it looking for a set piece, looking for a counter-attack. They played it as if they were happy to draw 0-0. Liverpool, by contrast, they go at it against Man City. They play them at their own game. It's end-to-end. They try and impose their own style. Arsenal didn't do that. And that's why the game was awful. Arteta's probably happy with the end result to come away with a point having said all of that, but I think that's interesting. Also, I know that you just come back in a second on this, Chris, but City's record this season against other teams in the top four, top five, I should say, because they 1-0, drawn 5, lost 1 against those teams, which is very un-Man City-like and confirms to me that, as we've said multiple times, this City team is not as good as the teams of recent years, and also confirms that, categorically, I will say this, I guarantee all three of these teams are dropping points again before the end of the season. If Liverpool were to win all of their games, they'd be on 94 points, which I think shows that, I mean, with that kind of running, finishing the season with 10 wins in a row to only get 94 compared to previous seasons, it is more competitive at the moment. You know, the gap isn't as big to the rest of the league. But yeah, I don't think any of these teams are going perfect till the end of the season. And it's probably going to be, do you know what? I know you want to make an extra point, but I'll kind of throw a question in here, Chris. If I said to you now, Liverpool get, I've said, you know, 94 is the max that they can get. If I said Liverpool get 90 points now, and obviously you don't know how the league finishes, but I said to you, I'd offer you 90 points and you can walk away. Would you take that?
I'm going to get up Arsenal's fixtures while I'm thinking of an answer to that question. the point I was going to make was, I said during the game, it was nothing like a Liverpool v Man City game. It was, I generally think it was two teams that were just happy not to lose. And I think that became clearer as the game went on as a whole. Just getting Arsenal's fixtures up. So the big one for Arsenal, they've got Luton at home, Brighton away, Villa at home, Wolves away, Chelsea at home, Tottenham away, Bournemouth at home, Manchester United away, and Everton at home. 90 points. So Arsenal can only get to what?
Let's have a look. So if Arsenal are on 65 now,
I'm trying to do maths here.
Theoretically, they could get 92 at the end of the season.
If you offered me 90, I'm taking it.
Yeah, I'd probably agree with that. I think, obviously, that would mean two draws between now and the end of the season, but I think it might be enough. I do.
I think the big one for Arsenal, just looking at this fixture list, it's that four-game run, and I know Chelsea are borderline abysmal this season, but it's the four-game run of Chelsea, Tottenham, Bournemouth and Manchester United where you feel that's the big one in terms of if they are to drop points. Because I've referenced cities already. I think City. So I think City have got a Spurs away game to rearrange. I think that's the one that they're waiting on. But if I'm looking at City's fixtures now, it wouldn't surprise me if they won them all. It really wouldn't. So based on the fact, Arsenal can get 92, City can get 91. But as you've said, they just don't look as good as last season. But I think if City raise their levels, I think Liverpool would as well. And I think that's what makes it a really exciting battle for the end of the season. Just one touch on Arsenal defensively, just because you mentioned it. Saliba and Van Dijk is absolutely locked in for team of the season.
Yeah.
Absolutely locked in. So
He's a special player.
That's just me throwing it out there.
Yeah. And obviously crucial to Arsenal's defensive solidity, but, you know, in fairness to Van Dijk, and this was a point that we made on the podcast during the week, he's had to deal and had to deal today with basically not having many of his first choice or any of his first choice sort of partners with him in that back line, and he's held it all together so well, which is for me what edges him ahead of Saliba in that conversation between the two this season anyway. I'll be honest, my head's gone. Liverpool are there's 9 games to go till the end of the season. It's in Liverpool's hands. They know if they win all of them, they win the title. As I said, I'm pretty sure they won't do that. But to be top going into April has caused head loss for me. I will admit that. So I don't imagine things are going to get any smoother between now and the end of the season. I think it's going to be very intense. But I'll try and obviously hold all that together on this podcast anyway. The good news is that Liverpool now into a spell where they're getting players back from injury, and I will touch on when I say that, because We know that it's been the case before. Players have come back, got injured again, or different players have got injured. So you can never count your chickens on that front. But I think it's looking good in terms of Alisson, Trent, Jota, and first of all, Curtis Jones too. So they could all obviously be difference makers. To get to this point in the season, in this position, with all those injuries is an extraordinary effort. And if Liverpool don't win the title from here, I'm not going to have any anger towards them whatsoever unless something crazy happens, because I just think they've exceeded all expectations, including pretty much everybody who's on this podcast over the course of the season. So hopefully that takes some of the pressure off them, but I don't think it'll actually work out like that. But anyway, we will leave it there for today's podcast. Obviously, 9 finals to go, like they say, and we'll see if all 3 teams are still staying in there right to the wire. In this title race, which isn't like anything we've really experienced before, certainly under Jurgen Klopp. But thanks very much, everyone, for listening. Thanks to Chris for jumping on. We'll be back in midweek when Liverpool have played Sheffield United and hopefully taken another step in the right direction. Until then, please give us a 5-star review if you've enjoyed this podcast, and remember to vote in the poll in the episode description about next season's content that I mentioned on the previous episode. But yeah, like I said, we'll see you in midweek. And until then, take care.